hate to break up the conversations, but it is time for us to start. I like that we have so much fun in talking to each other on Sunday morning, especially when we're all kind of trying to get into the swing of things for what a Sunday usually entails. But I've been waiting all week for this one moment. Everybody ready? We have a lot to talk about this morning. We have a lot to talk about this morning. We're talking about a lot. Yeah, that's it. Best pun I've ever said. Something like that. Talking about lesser known people of the Bible. And we know very little about Lot. We don't know a lot about Lot. But what we do know, we often kind of mention and reference specifically to Abraham, and for good reason. But Lot in and of himself is a pretty complex individual. He had a very unique family dynamic, to say the least. And we have some comments that we can make about some choices that he made and some things that he did. Not all of them are negative, believe it or not. If you know anything about Lot, you know we often focus on that little last part when it comes to him deciding to move his family to a place called Sodom. Not a great place to bring a family, I hear. But that was one decision that we often bring up. But it's not the first decision that we see that gives us some color on the character of who Lot was. So let's begin reading together in Genesis chapter 11. I am so glad that I made beautiful PowerPoints for this morning sermon, this evening sermon, and our Bible class. And then I got here and turned the projector on and realized, oh, wait. I might have missed something that's obstructing our view. So you're going to have to use your own Bibles this morning. Genesis chapter 11. We're going to begin reading in verse 27. This begins the descendants, the genealogies of a man named Terah. This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. That's very important to mention here. So we have one guy, Terah, who's the daddy of a guy named Abram. Who is Abram? Later called Abraham, right? Father of many nations. A very important individual, of course, for the patriarchy when it comes to passing down the law of what God would have mankind to do. It went through the eldest male of the family, of the clan, if you will, and then it went on to the next one and so on. Like we see in the book of Job, he made sacrifices for his entire family, even when they were in their own homes, because he was the patriarch. So we have Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran, which is very important, by the way, because there's going to be a place that's going to be named after Haran or where he lived, and it's not really the name of that location. It's just a reference point of that's where this guy lived. So it's kind of the home base for this family. So important to mention there. And Haran begot Lot. So what does that make Abram and Lot when it comes to relation? Nephew and uncle, right? So that's how we would normally see it. There is a little bit of overlap, though, in this very early stage when it comes to genealogy. And so there are some things that are going to be said about Sarah specifically that is a little bit more unconventional when it comes to the way that we think about families. We normally don't intermingle our families too much, but back here early in these times in the book of Genesis, sometimes that's just how it was done. There's a bunch of reasons for that. First of all, population was not going to be as large as what it is now, almost 4 billion people on the planet, right? So population is going to be a little bit different. There were a lot of people, sure, before the flood, but this is definitely a different time. Secondly, when it comes to where you came from, what family you originated from, that was very, very, very important when it came to early civilization. And so what you would often find is you wouldn't normally marry or have children with anyone outside of your immediate clan, so a couple of generations there. Because you want to kind of keep the family all together. If you think about England and Europe, when it comes to right before the Renaissance, that was not so much of a good thing, right? Often there were some gene problems that came because of this intermarrying and having children with your relatives and so on. But back here, early in Earth history, for a variety of supposed reasons, this was not going to be that big of a deal. So anyway, just one thing to kind of keep in mind here, the genealogy when it comes to the beginning of Genesis is going to look a little different than how we normally see things in our more advanced timeline. All right, so verse 28. And Haran died before his father Terah in his native land in the Ur of the Chaldeans. So if you're looking for a city name, a location that we can kind of reference point for the beginning of all of this, Ur is that location. And we have a good idea of where that is. It's definitely in Mesopotamia, definitely in kind of the eastern part of the Middle East. But really, when it comes to archaeology, we have a good record of exactly what life was like in this location at this point in time in history. And it was way more advanced than what you might think. I know in my mind, when I think about Old Testament times, I immediately think about a caveman. I don't know why. This way I grew up, I guess. But I think about people in caves with flint knives going hunting and gathering and so on. And that's not the case. They had great architecture when it comes to thinking about how far advanced they were in the world. They had two or three story homes made of dirt, but they were two or three story homes. So you had to have an engineer, a designer, to be able to make sure that structure was sound enough to support an entire family in one dwelling. That's pretty big accomplishment for being so early in history. Most impressively, they had a very crude but a very important system of irrigation and plumbing, basically, is how they would use aqueducts to actually bring water and waste out of homes. So that's pretty advanced, if you think about it. That's where they were in the Ur of Chaldees. And so Haran was at that location, and basically from this point forward, we're going to call this land in which he dwelled Haran, and no longer Ur, because that's where his family was. So, verse 29. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarah, or Sarai, if you want to be really proper about it. And the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, the father of Iscah. So we can kind of see some blending going on here. You can't see. Verse 30. But Sarah was broken. That's not what it says. She was barren, and she had no child. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot and the son of Haran and the daughter-in-law Sarah and Abram's wife and his son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from the Ur of Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan, and they came to Haran and dwelt there. So remember, Haran's used here as a location in which his now-deceased brother was dwelling. Now they're going from the Ur of Chaldees to Haran. We don't have a geographical location that tells exactly where that was, but it wasn't all the way to Canaan. We know that for sure. So, verse 32. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So everybody moved down from the Ur of Chaldees to Haran. That's where everybody's located. Abraham's daddy passes away. And then we pick up our story in chapter 12 with a little bit of time advancing, if you imply what we read here in verses 1, 2, and 3. And this is where we find one of the greatest verses, sections of Scripture, is Genesis chapter 12, 1, 2, and 3. It doesn't seem like that big of a deal when you first read it, but every time it's referenced later in the Bible, everything goes back to this original promise that was made to Abraham, and this is the original location of it. So, Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord had said, past tense is important there, to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. So let's pause right there. What is God telling Abram, later Abraham, to do? Leave home. Get away from your family, get away from your tribe, get away from your clan, and go to a new land that I will direct you towards. Why was that such a big deal? I mean, yeah, families, they didn't really travel too much apart. If you went away from your clan, away from your tribe, away from your family, you were leaving a lot of social and physical protection. If people didn't know who you were, they thought you were bandits or raiders or whatever, that's definitely a dangerous situation to be in. If you don't have your family around you to support you when it comes to economics, when it comes to health, everything, your family being in your physical location was very, very important, especially this early point in history. Jim?
But I would think it would take a lot of faith on Abraham's part to listen and do what God told him that when he goes somewhere, I don't know what it is, but God's going to show him.
Yeah.
To me, that takes a lot of faith in God.
Absolutely, right? So Hebrews chapter 11, the so-called Hall of Fame of Faith, Abraham's mentioned, right? So is Sarah, importantly. They both listen to this charge to go away from their homeland, go away from where their family was, and go out to a land not knowing where you're going to go. And they went. It's very, very courageous. Verse 2, here's the continuation of the promise. If you do that, is implied, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. So let's pause here at the beginning of verse 2. I will make you a great nation. Now, we understand that Abraham himself was not going to become a sovereign state, right? So what's meant by he is going to become a great nation? Your descendants are going to make up a great nation. Yeah, the only wife you got can't bear a child, right? No doubt they knew that at this point in time. It's not like they just got married yesterday. And he's got this promise. If you leave your country, you leave your family, and you go to a land that you don't know where it is, but I'll show you where it is. If you do that, I'll make you a great nation. And that great nation became what nation? The Israelites, right? We don't see that really come to fruition truly until they're in captivity in Egypt, right? When those couple of families that moved in because of famine, because Joseph was there to save the day, when they all moved down there a couple generations later, a new Pharaoh rose up and they were so afraid of the Jews because there were so many of them, right? So all of that fear came from this original man and wife that were given this promise. So the origin story of everything in Exodus comes from this passage right here. So, verse 3. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. That's important because it's a change in scope here. We go from you get away from your family, from your homeland in Haran, right, where his brother dwelt. So if you do that, I will make of you, from your generations, a great nation. So much so that you're going to be a powerful, well-known person. And then I'm going to be with you in the state that whenever someone is nice to you, I'll be nice to them. If they're mean to you, I'll be mean to them, to kind of simplify the entire idea here. And then, in some way, all the families over all the earth are going to be blessed by you. Now, that's the change. Why or how was that great blessing on all the families of the earth brought to pass? What happened? Through Christ. Do you think Abraham fully realized exactly what in the world was going on? I really doubt it. Really doubt it. He may have been given a glimpse into what was going to happen through his lineage, through his seed line, but the Messiah, the anointed one of God, the Christ, the perfect Lamb of God would come through this man and his wife, beginning with then leaving home. All of that is kind of like a chain effect, right? If they never left Haran, then none of this would have happened and we wouldn't have a Messiah. So thankfully, Abram left home. Okay, questions, comments? All right, so we're not talking about Abraham, right? Talking about a different guy named Lot. So verse 4, we learn about him. And Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him. I would have loved to have a little verse in between verse 3 and verse 4 before God making that promise and then ending his promise. And then him deciding that they was going to leave. I would love to hear how that conversation went down when Abram talked to his wife. I would love to have just a little glimpse as to what her state of mind was. Because Sarah, for all that she was an interesting lady. She had a lot of little moments where you get a glimpse of her, and I would have loved to know a little bit more about her. When an angel of the Lord, after they already left, they've been doing this for a while, an angel of the Lord came and told her that she was going to bear a son. What did she do? She laughed at an angel of God who told her that she was going to bear a child. She laughed in his face. Well, yeah, I would too. If you laugh at an angel, it's like, did you laugh at me? Like, I mean, no. No, of course not. Goes, all right, so you're not Sarah anymore. You're Sarah because you laughed. Thanks a lot. Laughter. So, I mean, that's the ultimate kind of God changes your name because you laughed at his messenger. I mean, what are you going to do? So Sarah did that, right? And then later you read in the New Testament about when it comes to the relationship of husband and wife and male and female, a reference is made that Sarah would actually call Abram, or later Abraham, Lord or Master, which, of course, has some negative connotation in our context today, obviously. But the application is made from that Sarah understood her role when it came to being a wife and to be the mother of any nations, if you will. And she still had enough respect for her husband, who made a ton of mistakes publicly, to respect his authority as the head of the household. It's a very unusual dynamic there. So you got a lady who decides that she, yes, is going to leave everything that she knows because God told her husband to. And then she laughs at an angel in her face, and her name gets changed in spite of that. And then she still has enough obedience and respect to her husband for the love of God to call him Lord or Sir, if you will. So it's a very interesting dynamic with her. So anyway, verse 4, Abram departs from the Lord as the Lord has spoken to him. And then this little thing is tacked on. And Lot went with him. Is the promise given to Lot? Verses 1, 2, and 3. No. He's got no guarantee, if he goes with Abram, of any real protection, of any real security, of any real inherent blessing. I mean, there's no mention of Lot. Lot's not the chosen one, right? He's not the guy that we're to be focusing on, but Lot chooses to go with him. So what's their relationship again? Uncle and nephew, right? So it's probably a closer family unit than we would probably experience this given the world in which they lived. But no doubt, they obviously had some kind of relationship in which Lot was comfortable and willing to go with Abram. And we're going to learn that Lot's got family, he's got livestock, he's got things, so he's not just a single guy just kind of going along for the ride. He's making a commitment to go with Abram. Very interesting decision. Jim. Yeah. It could be. There was another brother, though. So you've got one brother, right? Abram's other brother who wasn't passed away. If he's living in Haran with the family, it would have been easier, I think, to probably stay with the brother who's in his home base where all the family is, all their stuff is. That would have been secure, as opposed to hearing your uncle say, God told me to go to a place and he's going to bless me and make from me a great nation. Oh, where is it? No idea. So you're just going to pack up all your stuff, get in your U-Haul, and just drive where God tells you to go? Yeah. I'll go with you. Great plan. So Sarah went. We often emphasize how important Sarah's decision-making and allowing Abram or going with Abram to go into this unknown territory was, but I rarely think about Lot doing the same exact thing with no inherent blessing. At least Sarah knew she was going to have a child sooner or later, right? And Lot had no promises. So as we think about him and as we try to uncover what we know about him based on the verses that we have, which is all we can do, that's how I want to start. As I want to begin with the impression that this man had enough faith, maybe not in God, but at least in Abraham, to go with him in the first place. So maybe he trusted God too. I don't know. We're going to see later on he at least had a respect for people in a general way. But he went with Abram as well. Okay? So Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Now, keeping in mind here the obvious implication, they lived a little bit longer than we do. The life expectancy for a person was around 200 years or so at this point in time. That's going to dramatically drop off as the generations continue. And so if he's 75, he's a young tyke, right? He's just getting started in the world. Sure, he's got a few gray hairs, but he's good to go. He's ready to roll. He's fine. 125 years. I mean, his dad's life expectancy, everything's all right. So he's a young tyke. Verse 5. And then Abram took Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. All right, so there's some very important implications, obviously, from verse 5. We understand that in the Old Testament, and even up into the New Testament, there was a social dynamic that was already in place. And it's been in place for a very long time, and only really recently is it a thing that we discourage, that we don't allow, that we see as illegal, and so on. That's the idea of slavery. And slavery has a very loaded background, especially in our country. When we see slavery, a certain image comes to mind. But slavery in our culture's history is different, and is different in every single culture. And I often emphasize how in the first century, when you talk about how a slave or a bond servant is supposed to deal with a master, and then a master is supposed to deal with a bond servant, especially if they're both Christians, there's definitely a different dynamic there than someone who is a taskmaster over someone who's a subordinate. And so we often relate, especially in the New Testament, the idea of slavery or service to the idea of an employee-employer relationship, because in a lot of ways, in a lot of contexts, that's exactly what it is. If you've got a Christian boss, and you've got a Christian employee, that relationship of a master and a bondservant from the New Testament definitely comes into play. I've mentioned to you before that I've had a few jobs in my life, and one of them was managing a movie theater. And we just got so lucky enough to be able to hire basically our entire youth group from church to work at the movie theater. So it was a really cool environment to be in. Really interesting dynamic, especially when you had someone that wasn't from our church come in as an employee, and then everybody that they came in contact with was a Christian from our youth group. That's a very interesting dynamic, right? So the way that I treated them and the way they treated me ideally should have been somewhat distinct or different than how you would normally treat an employee or employer in that relationship, and it definitely was. But again, we were all teenagers, so there's only so much you can do when it comes to maturity, right? So I say all of that to say, when we look at Abraham, we see Sarah, and we see that their servants, their handmaidens, and their slaves are with them. Don't immediately jump to the connotation that we have in our culture, our country's history of what slavery was. It definitely wouldn't be ideal to not paint any kind of false picture for you. But it's not immediately evil, as we so often think from our history, when of course it was. So anyway, verse 5, Abraham took Sarah, his wife, his nephew, all their stuff that they had gathered, and all the people that they had acquired there, and for lack of a better idea here, all their employees, all their house servants, if you will, and they left to go to the land of Canaan. And then you kind of get this concluding statement here at the very end of verse 5. So they came to the land of Canaan. Like it was just pack up and then move one day away. Everything is fine. Just take getting a U-Haul and drive it. No, it was a huge ordeal. This was a new world that they were trying to explore away from the security of what they knew from their family, from their brother's land, all this stuff. They're going to a new place. Okay, questions, comments? I'm sure I wasn't specific enough to be as clear as I would like about the idea of slavery in the Old and New Testament, but that's kind of the best I can do right now, anyway. All right, so forgive my inability. All right, verse 6. We're not going to read, by the way, all of the stuff about Abraham, because a lot's not really involved in all of that, but I'm trying to give you a sweeping picture of what this whole situation was. Because if you just jump into it in certain passages, you're missing the dynamic of all how important this was and what faith it took for Lot to at least go with Abraham in the first place, right? And so verse 6. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Morah, which of course everyone knows. And the Canaanites were then in the land. So when they were going to this land of Canaan, there were people from Canaan already there. That's taught to us here in this passage. And then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel. Keeping in mind here, they're using the accommodative names from the current time that they knew where Bethel was. So they're referencing Bethel here, although it was not called Bethel then, right? Keeping that in mind. And he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. Very important locations later in the history of the Jews, for obvious reasons. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abram journeyed, going on still towards the south. Now, one side note that I have to mention, it's going to bug me if I don't. Verse 8, the very end, there he built an altar to the Lord. And what did he do? He called on the name of the Lord. What in the world does that mean? I'll tell you what it's not. That might help you. The reason why I focus on that is because that saying, called on the name of the Lord, is used in the patriarchal age, is used in the law of Moses age, is also used in the Christian age, is even used today. And the way that we often hear that phrase, those who call on the name of the Lord shall be saved in the New Testament, means as long as you recognize that God is who God is, and Jesus is who Jesus is, and you believe it, then you're going to be saved. And I really wish that was it. But that's not fair, because you're implying just from that one passage, it means what you think it means. But it can't just mean belief. It can't just mean a confession, because it's used in the patriarchal age, the Mosaic age, and the Christian age, with all different implications of what they actually did when they were those who were calling on the name of the Lord. What happened here in verse 8? He built an altar to the Lord. What's an altar used for? You kill something on it, all right? He built an altar to the Lord for the intent of worshiping God, and he called on the name of the Lord. So that mean that he killed an animal, and then he was like, you know what? I believe you're there. It wouldn't make any sense. It's a different context, different world in which we're living. To kind of give you the Cliff Notes version of it, every time you look at that phrase, someone who called on the name of the Lord, basically what we see is someone obeying what they were supposed to do to be pleasing to God. That's the short version of the answer. Every time you see that figure of speech, they called on the name of the Lord. It doesn't mean they just said, hey, Lord, I know you're there. They're doing something that God asked them to do with which he would be well pleased. And if that's the true meaning of what it means to call on the name of the Lord, then the New Testament actually means what it says, which means those who call on the name of the Lord, those who do what God would be pleased with them doing and obeying his commands, shall be saved. That's simple. Let's go over there for a second, just because I want to conclude this thought on a note of application. Acts 22:16, we often talk about this passage when it comes to baptism. This is Paul, after his conversion, while he's on trial, giving a statement as to what he did to become a Christian, right? That's kind of hearing it from the horse's own mouth. We heard it from Luke, through inspiration about what happened to Saul, but here is Saul, as Paul, as a Christian, telling what he had to do. It really begins in verse 6, so Acts 22 and verse 6, now as it happened, as I journeyed and came near Damascus at about noon, suddenly a great light from heaven shone around me. Same thing that Luke recorded by inspiration earlier in the text, right? And if you jump down to verse 14, and then he said, the God of our fathers hath chosen you, that you should know his will, and see the just one, and hear the voice of his mouth. For you will be his witness to all men of what you have heard and seen. So who's the person speaking here in verse 14, 15, and 16? It's a guy named Ananias. He was a preacher that was sent to go tell Saul what he had to do to be saved. And now verse 16, and now, why are you waiting? Why are you tarrying? Why are you, there's a lag in your reaction. Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins And what are you doing while you arise, you're being baptized and having your sins washed away, calling on the name of the Lord? It wouldn't make any sense for him to just simply say, Lord, I believe that you're there, because he already said that when he had that light that shone around and said, Lord, who are you? He recognized he was someone that was impressive enough to call Lord in that moment. And so calling on the Lord is used in almost an accommodative way. So the context dictates how we interpret that meaning. And here is one of the first times we read about it, Abraham doing that while he received that second reiteration of the promise from chapter 12, 1, 2, and 3. Okay, that's kind of a side note, but it's important to know, because it can be confusing if you're not aware about that figure of speech. Okay, questions, comments? All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to jump forward just a little bit. Abraham makes a mistake for the first time. He goes to a city in which there is a ruler, and the ruler is impressive enough where Abraham is afraid of him just taking his wife and killing him. So he decides to kind of come up with a half-truth, whole lie, and says, hey, look, you're my sister, right? And she goes, I guess. So when they get there, they say, who is this lady right here? Which, keeping in mind her age, she was an attractive lady, even for being someone who was 74 years old, or maybe even more at this point. And in this day and age, that would have been, of course, a little different. But keeping that in mind, he says, who's this lady right here? Oh, she's my sister. Oh, so she's free then. Great. I'll just go ahead and take her if you don't mind. And then, of course, the Lord's like, no, that's not how it's going to work. You need Sarah. Stop doing this. So chapter 13, verse 1, we pick up a situation in which they escape that situation. And we read this. And then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him. You see, I was kind of tacked on again. Lot just happened to be there. To the south. Abram was very rich in livestock, silver, and in gold. So he had done pretty well for himself. The whole, I'll bless him that blesses you and curse him that curses you thing was actually paying off pretty good. Verse 3, and he went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel, so back to the place where we just talked about, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, and to the place of the altar which he had first made there. Sound familiar, right? We just read that a second ago. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. It's like deja vu. Same thing's happening here. He gets back to where he was at the beginning. Everything is going well, but his pockets are nice and lined with gold and silver, and livestock are in there too, I'm sure. And he's happy about where he is, and so he's thankful. And so what does he do? He sacrifices to the Lord at the original altar where he was before all this stuff went down. Verse 5. Lot also, he's tacked on there as well, who went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. So Abram's blessing was kind of rubbing off on Lot as well. Things were going well for them as kind of a family unit moving through this territory. And now the land was not able to support them, that they might dwell together, for all their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. Now, how does that make any sense? Why was the land not able to support their wealth? What does that mean? What enough grazing land? There wasn't enough grass to go around. When you measured your wealth on, depending on how many heads of cattle, or not cattle, that's Texas, how many sheep, how many goats you've got, it's important to keep those things alive, right? And to keep them alive, you don't want to eat them all, you don't want to sacrifice them all, you don't want to lose them to predators and so on, but you also want to keep them fed. And they were so wealthy when it came to their livestock that when they were going through this original territory where they were, they realized our wealth is dropping like flies. So we're going to have to figure this out. We're too rich to live together. It's a good problem to have, but it's still a problem. And this is the most important part. Verse 7. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. So not only was there scarce resources for these goats and sheep to stay alive when it came to food, but you've also got these cowboys that were in charge of rounding them all up and keeping them all safe. They weren't getting along very well. Now, I can only suspect why they didn't get along that well. They came from different cultures. They had different languages, maybe. They had different ideas. But I think one of the more contentious problems would have been if you are guarding the flock of Abram and a few sheep go astray and they happen to get rounded up by Lot's herdsmen and the wealth is kind of fluctuating based on who's in charge of what, that's going to cause some frictions. That's one idea that I've heard. It makes some sense to me, but I'm not sure. It doesn't say right here in the text, so it's just one idea. At the very end of verse 7, the Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. Why is that important to mention? Because they're not in their own home country. They're not on their ranch with all their stuff and all their people and all their barbed wire fences to protect what they've got. They are traveling from Egypt to Bethel through enemy tribal territory, trying to keep everybody together and keep everything safe. So there's going to be a lot of complications when it comes to the daily ordeal of them just going from point A to point B, right? It's a very complex situation. In verse 8, there is a solution to the problem. And I think it's important to mention here that Abram is of the mind to solve this issue. He's a very typical man. He wants to see a problem. He wants to fix the problem. There's no more problem. So here's Abraham solving the problem. He says to Lot, please, let there be no strife between you and me, between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. He goes, look, we're a family. We shouldn't be upset each other over this problem. We're both just too wealthy for all this, right? Let's solve the problem. Is not the whole land before you? Look out. Everything here is open for you, right? Please separate from me. If you take the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. So what's his solution? He says, look, we have to split up. I mean, I don't want to. We're family and everything, but we got to split up. We got to part ways. You pick which way you want to go. If you go over here, I'll go over there. I won't fight you for it. No problem. You want to go over here? I'll go over there. No problem. I don't care. It's important enough to maintain this relationship as brethren. We need to come with a solution here. I love that. Because it shows a level of intelligence and wisdom and maturity and even humility. Abraham easily could have said, look, Lot, why are you following me around? You are just following me like a puppy dog. I never asked you to go. God didn't talk to you about this promise. Why don't you just go ahead and leave? If not, I'm going to take your stuff and kill you for it. Abraham could have said that, but he didn't. He wants to maintain this relationship based on the fact that he knows that God's going to bless him wherever he goes. That, I think, is very, very significant to mention. Okay, any addition to that? Comment to that? I don't know how I'd react, to be honest. God talked to me, said, I'm going to be the father of many nations. I had to change my name to mean father of many nations. I'm so rich now, I can do whatever I want. It's a lot of temptation before me. And the way he handled it was very, very humble. All right, verse 10. And Lot lifted up his eyes. He saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, because before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, which is important to mention because that's kind of a teaser for what's going to happen next. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go up towards Zoar. So he's looking around saying where he wants to go. He sees this lush, green, Garden of Eden-esque location. And then he sees barren, rocky, desert, dry land. And he's like, well, I could go here or I could go here. What do you think he's going to pick? Where would you pick? I'll go to where's green. If you're thirsty, you're not going to go to the middle of a desert. You're going to go to an oasis. That's exactly what he saw here. All right, so verse 11. And then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan. And Lot journeyed east. and they separated from each other. That's an important decision. Very, very important decision. There are a few ways that you can apply that situation to your own life. If you know the situation, you know how this concludes, who made the right call in the end? Going towards the Garden of Eden-esque location or going towards the plains? The plains, the place that didn't look as nice, the place that, although it wasn't as tantalizingly beautiful, it still had the promise of God, no matter where you go, he's going to be with you and bless you. Abraham knew that. And apparently he trusted that. Otherwise, he'd say, I'm going to go there, you go over here, right? Lot chose what looked best to him at that moment. And it ended up being a crucial decision because it shaped not only his life, but the life of him, his wife, and his entire family. They were now going to grow up in an environment that was less than ideal, shall we say. And it all came from this decision for him to go that way. Same thing sometimes can be true of us. We look at our options. And sometimes we see something that looks really nice. Looks really good. Something that we think we really want. And we're willing to go that way, even away from the promises of God. And that can change everything for us. Also for our families. And so the application that we're making from this, at least in the first kind of simplistic part, is appearance is not everything, as if you didn't already know that, right? Lot made this decision based on the information that he had, but it still was the wrong call. Okay, questions, comments? Yeah, I mean, he should have been like, so y'all are Sodomites, huh? You're from Sodom? Interesting lifestyle choice, but I'm going to abstain and get my family away from here, not move in, right? All right, verse 12, and then we'll conclude our thoughts. Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. So he was still kind of moving around to all the cities, but he camped out near a place called Sodom. And we'll make application about that and continuing our conversation next week, Lord willing. Okay, thank you for your attention. That's a little bit about a lot. And so we'll conclude our thoughts this morning and be dismissed for about 15 minutes.